Representative Craig Johnson. And also on teleconference with us today is Senator Joe Pasquin, Representative Peggy Wilson, and Jesse Van Der Zanden from Fairbanks Airport, as well as we're going to be joined with Senator Betty Davis at some point here. So with that, we'll go ahead and begin, and we'll have opening remarks, I guess, from me. I'm just calling this meeting to order because we're very honored to have a new Deputy Commissioner of the Airport Aviation, and it's important when we have these large committees that is, you know, that represent so many wonderful employees with the Department of Transportation that we meet people and we understand what is going on in their departments the best we can. So we're starting with this overview of aviation. So I'd like to welcome all the committee members, and I'd like to make note here on my left is my committee aide, and that is Chuck Heath, and then Mike Rovito is my lead staffer, but, well, there he is there. Okay, so thank you for all the work trying to put this together as well. And we did see Representative Les Garris was in. He had an update of Representative Mike Dugan. For those of you that don't know, he's in some serious trouble with his health, and he's in Seattle, but the prognosis is looking good, so I think he'll be back in a short amount of time. So we certainly are thinking wonderful thoughts and prayers in his direction. Now I'm going to introduce our new Deputy of Aviation, Mark Lucan, and to do that, we will have our Commissioner, Leo Von Shaven, come forward and give a bio on him. That would be interesting and appropriate. Thank you, Leo.
Sure.
State your name for the record, please, and affiliate.
Leo Von Shaven, I'm the Commissioner of Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I have a very interesting resume here. I'm going to share some highlights with you. My new Deputy Commissioner in Aviation, Mark Lucan, served 29 years in the Air Force before retiring on June 1st, 2010. During his previous Air Force assignment, he oversaw the mission execution for two flying wings, 15 long-range radars, and two additional facilities. By the way, I'm just giving you some highlights. This resume is really impressive. After graduating from the United States Academy in 1981, Colonel Lucan was commissioned in the United States Air Force. He has held a variety of command and staff assignments worldwide. During the operation in Desert Storm, Colonel Lucan served as the Director of Operations for the 8th Air Support Operations Center Squadron, providing close air support to the U.S. 7 Corps units. Colonel Lucan has led several organizations in the United States Air Force focused on supporting flying operations and base infrastructure. As the 48 Operations Support Squadron Commander, Colonel Lucan led the most diverse organization in his flying wing, which included airfield operations and air traffic control. Colonel Lucan was responsible for the 29,000-acre Tyndall Air Force Base near Panama City, Florida, with over $4.1 billion in assets. He commanded security, fire, construction, facilities, services, contracting, personnel, communications, and logistics organizations. He managed a $42 million annual budget and a $51 million construction budget, including a major runway renovation project. Colonel Lucan earned his bachelor's degree in human factors engineering from the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, Colorado. He earned a master's degree in management from Troy State University in Alabama and a second master's degree in strategic studies from the Air University in Alabama. He is a distinguished graduate from the Squadron's Officer School, a graduate of Air Command and Staff College, Armed Forces Staff College, and Air War College. He is a command pilot with 4,000 flying hours, and those hours are fast hours, by the way. He has experience as an instructor pilot, a fighter pilot, a maintenance test pilot, and most recently, a light transport pilot flying in Beechcraft King Air. Some of Colonel Wilkins' awards and decorations include the Legion of Merit, Air Force Command Medal, the Aerial Achievement Medal, Air Force's Expeditionary Medal, and over 15 campaign and service medals. He is a member of the Air Force Association and Rotary International. Very, very impressive man, and he's a good guy. I really enjoyed working with him. Started working in June, and he has hit the ground running. I think you'll find him pleasant to be around, and I guess what I see is a person who is tied to aviation, not only as a technical person, but also one that flies airplanes and understands that part of our system, and that's what aviation is all about. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mark, and he'll make a presentation to you regarding the aviation system. So.
Thank you very much for that stellar bio. We appreciate hearing all these wonderful things. Come forward, please. And if you just, for the record, state your name and affiliation. Thank you.
I'm Mark Lucan. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Transportation for Aviation. Chairman Nard and Transportation Committee members, I want to thank you for this opportunity to provide you an update on aviation here in Alaska. And as your Deputy Commissioner of Aviation, I'm excited to be part of the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I'm encouraged to work with such a dedicated group here in the statewide aviation and the Alaska International Aviation System, airport system. As you know, we have the largest aviation system in North America, and it's tremendously important to our state. So, and our people and our economy. So I'm proud to be part of an organization with this kind of impact, and I look forward to working with all of you as we promote safe and efficient air transportation here in Alaska.
We'll go ahead and hit the lights. How are we doing, Michael? Okay. Okay, I think we can get started. I don't think it's a problem.
Sure. Well, you've asked me to give you an update on Alaska's international airport system and our statewide aviation system, and you also asked me what I intended to focus on as the new Deputy Commissioner for Aviation. So I'll cover these three areas throughout the brief. The Alaska International Airport System is really the air freight gateway for trade and commerce between North America and Asia. I don't know if you know, but 5% of the value of all U.S. international cargo passes through Anchorage. It passed through Anchorage in 2008. That's roughly $41 billion worth of merchandise, and really that's an awful lot of iPhones. Anchorage is a tech stop for the international freighters. They refuel here so they can maximize the amount of cargo that they transfer between Asia and North America. As you can see from this chart, if you look at the green line, we are just about up to pre-recession levels in our combined cargo and passenger landing counts. The other thing to note, while I don't have a chart, is that our certified maximum gross takeoff weight is actually equivalent to the 06 levels where we were in 06. So we are moving back toward what we experienced pre-2008. But one of the issues that is a challenge for us, and you asked me to mention it, is the fact that they really do need to be reassured of fuel availability. And right now, we do have a shortage of reliable and stable fuel. And as a result, roughly 25 aircraft a week are overflying Anchorage because of that. The recession caused one of our significant discrete production units to be taken offline. And recovering demand has not yet justified the sustained production at pre-recession levels, and may not be for some time. Interim measures right now are being pursued, such as bringing up the number 3 tower up at Flint Hills. And it has started production again this summer, and right now the Alaska Railroad is moving about 700,000 gallons a day back down to support the operations down here. And we're going to continue to work with the fuel stakeholders, our suppliers, the buyers, et cetera, to make sure that we have adequate supplies through the winter.
And Mark, since it's just Representative Johnson and myself, if we can ask questions, I was going to have them hold their questions, but there's a few on teleconference, and we just got a note from Senator Myers. He's going to be joining us shortly. So if you have any questions that pop in your head, we can go ahead and, is that agreeable? Okay, thank you.
Ask a question.
This is Joe Paskfan. Hello.
Good morning, Joe. Nice to hear your voice. Welcome.
It is nice to hear yours. You know, my concern or the question that I would pose, I understand that there's a jet fuel consortium that has been formed in Anchorage to address the jet fuel shortfalls, that they're dealing with the importing of jet fuel. And, you know, what I'm focused upon is, you know, what are they doing? What are the savings, if any, that they're able to achieve in that regard? And just kind of an open-ended question as far as that jet fuel consortium.
Well, there is a jet fuel consortium, and they are, you know, they manage the fuel for those folks that are in their consortium. And if you'd allow me, I'd like to call my fuel expert up, and that's John Parrott from the Anchorage International Airport. He's been working this issue for quite some time, certainly well before I arrived on the scene, and can probably provide you a more detailed look at really what the fuel issue is that we're dealing with.
Okay, I think this is as good a time to defer to John. If you come up, please.
He can provide probably the most concise explanation for this.
Good morning. I'm John Parrott with the Ted Stevens Anchorage. With the Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport, a brief bit of background: the fuel consortium has actually existed for many years. It's not a recently formed organization. The fuel consortium manages the storage and the piping of the fuel for the consortium members. Each individual airline still buys the fuel independently from the suppliers that they choose to use, and there are a number of suppliers. And obviously a number of airlines. Those business deals are all independent of the consortium. The consortium is responsible for about 20 million gallons of storage at the airport and about another 20 million gallons of storage at the port of Anchorage. And they are also responsible for the hydrant system at Anchorage International. This fuel situation first became apparent to us back in the pre-Christmas peak in November, and we've been working with the suppliers, the transporters, and the users since then, and in May held a meeting, sort of an internal statewide summit meeting of all the people involved with the fuel issue to ensure that everybody knew what everybody knew. And it was enlightening for a number of folks. The suppliers weren't aware of what the users' needs were. The users weren't aware of some of the suppliers' and producers' constraints. And so we've been working about 6 months now with trying to educate folks and both inside and outside of state agencies as to what can be done. I hope that answers the consortium question. It does not control fuel. It simply stores fuel that is under contract by the individual carriers.
Senator Paskfan, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Senator Menard. What I am interested in is, you know, there's 25 flights per week that you say are overflighting Alaska now. And in part, you know, the North Pole refineries, the Flint Hills refinery, is not producing as much volume as they used to produce. And I'm wondering what's the pricing mechanism that you may be aware of that may be inhibiting the full utilization of Alaska's petroleum resource as compared to importing, and what control does the jet fuel consortium play in that process?
Through the chair, Senator Paskfan, I can answer the last part first, the consortium has no control or input into the pricing mechanism of the fuel. The consortium members do pay a fee for the storage of the fuel, but the consortium does not buy or sell fuel. That is purely between the suppliers, the producers, and the end users. What happened with tower number three there in Flint Hills was really not a pricing issue, but a demand issue. In the end of 2008 and 2009, the annual demand for the Alaska International Airport system dropped about 300 million gallons per year, which is just about equivalent to the production capacity of tower number three. And so simply there was no demand for that fuel. It was taken offline. It is now back online and producing, and they plan to continue running that tower as long as there is adequate demand up until when the weather turns cold. And then they run into a number of technical issues that make it very difficult to operate it at part capacity through the low demand winter or to shut it down in the middle of the cold season. So that's some issues that Flint Hills is looking at. At the same time, we have some companies that are looking at obtaining contingency plans to bring in tanker fuel, which is not using Alaska's resources, but could conceivably meet the need of the air carriers.
Senator Pasfan, is that satisfactory?
That's enough for the moment, but thank you for the answer.
Okay, we'll move it along then with the side presentation.
You bet. Well, what you can see in this slide is that we are pretty much complete with construction activity at both Anchorage and Fairbanks. We've completed the new south terminal and the connector between the south and north terminals at Anchorage, and we also have a new terminal and runway up at Fairbanks, and they've both been in use. All of these facilities have been in use for about a year. And so right now we've got the capacity to handle all of the largest aircraft in that are flying in the world at both airports. What you'll see up here is that the gate N8 aircraft parking and then the access control improvements at Fairbanks, those are both American Restoration Recovery Act projects.
Money.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then we also have, as you can see, some runway work going on at Anchorage, and then just a small repair to our fire response facility there at Fairbanks. We talked with Representative Johnson about marketing a little earlier, but that is certainly one of the issues that is on my mind, and we are continuing to stress this to the larger community, and cargo is one of our biggest revenue drivers in our system, and so we're working to expand that competitive advantage as we continue to develop our air cargo infrastructure. And one of the ways that we're going to do that is through an air cargo summit in August. It's a good start, I think, to do that, and we expect about 30 international carriers. And when I say international, that doesn't necessarily mean just from outside the U.S., but certainly our U.S. domestic carriers who fly internationally. And the plan is, what we really want to try to do is discuss the cargo transfer advantages that some of the laws affecting Alaska have for them, and help them understand that, because we think that will really develop some greater opportunities. Not only for our airports, but certainly for those carriers. And I'm also
ask, you have an adequate budget for that marketing?
Yes.
To hike this?
Yes, we certainly do. And it's coming from the airport, really, but the airports.
Received.
But yes, but they see that as a good investment.
Mark, this is Representative Wilson. I have a question before we get into the rural airports. Quite a while back, and I can't remember how long, but there was some concern about the space and how it was used at the Anchorage Airport as that was getting redone and everything. Do you know if that has been addressed and if that is satisfactory now?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I'm not exactly sure what you may be referring to. If you, are you talking about space for the various carriers?
No, this was. I think this was office space.
Oh.
And that was just something that was brought to our attention the last time when we all met together, and I know that was before you were here, and so you might not know if it was addressed or not.
I think what you may be referring to, and I'll just tell you that from what I can tell, there's plenty of adequate space out there at the airport for our employees of the Anchorage International Airport,
okay,
that's what you're asking.
Well, I think there was some areas where they thought that they were using more space than it was really needed, and maybe that space could be rented out, or there could be income coming in because the space was pretty big for what they needed it for. So I don't know.
Representative Wilson, with all due respect, we do have the Anchorage Airport manager here, and we'll flip through these slides because that's a topic all in itself. So
okay.
If you can just hold your thoughts there, and I'll get right back with you on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And with us, we've been very honored that Senator Betty Davis has joined us, so I want the record to reflect that as well. Please continue.
Well, just to round this out, I think it is important that we ensure that we have a good marketing program for the airport, and so we are actually working to bring back a marketing team, the airport leadership is working with the Department of Administration to build this team and make sure that it's classified correctly, and we've already had one position classified, and expect the second one to be done here fairly soon so we can get it advertised and get these folks hired and just continue moving forward, getting the word out about Anchorage, our international airport system. Moving on to rural airports, I've given you a handout that gives you quite a bit of detail about the various construction projects that are going on around Alaska at our rural airports. And
we won't make you pronounce all those names. We'll be so kind.
I'll try not. Yeah, I won't pronounce all of them, but I will. I'm going to highlight a couple. But I will tell you that we have addressed many of the safety and regulatory needs throughout our statewide aviation system, and we're going to continue to make those a priority. One of our successes is out at Bethel Airport. It is the second busiest cargo airport in Alaska, and we just completed a new runway last year for Bethel, which has been a huge improvement for them out there. And we also have a new airport manager, Mr. Dave Cummings, who also manages the 27 smaller community airports that surround Bethel. We've also seen many other successes at our rural airports in the northern and southeastern region. As you can see from this chart, right now we don't have any current construction needs down in the southeast, which is really good news. But probably our biggest construction challenge, and I guess this is the point, is we've really kind of hit what I would call the low-hanging fruit, the things that are not that difficult, or at least relatively not as difficult to complete. And so we're going to start taking on the airports in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, as well as the Aleutian chain. And they are going to be more expensive. There's going to be longer lead time for construction preparation. And material availability, soil conditions, and access are all going to drive the cost of a lot of those airports pretty high. So one of the things that I'm trying to do is look at opportunities to help foster economic development, especially where we see growth in some of these smaller communities. And right now I see potential in Hooper Bay and at Savunga and at Talkeetna, and I'm going to work with my staff to try to find creative ways to open up some of those opportunities. But one of the things that you'll also maybe start to hear is the fact that we're going to look to the state or other sources for funding opportunities, for some of these projects.
And that's probably the final challenge that I'll talk to you about is the fact that we have seen some increased scrutiny from the federal level on our funded projects. And there's been indications that the federal government is going to expect the state to probably contribute a greater share of the match. And it's really just kind of a reflection of, you know, the national fiscal environment that we're finding ourselves in. Finally, I'll mention the fact that Allakaket, Fort Yukon, Husila, Akiachak, and Uzinki were also all ERA project construction projects. So we did get a pretty significant share of that for our airports. One of the I just want to show you an example. One of the airports that is out to bid right now and is going to be fairly challenging and expensive is Acatan, but it's very strongly supported by the commissioner and by other leadership around the state, and it's certainly the right thing to do for this community. But just wanted to mention that because you'll probably see more about that in the near future. These are the areas that I plan to focus on in the next few months, and there are areas that have been brought up by many of the aviation stakeholders that I've talked to recently. And probably the first thing I'm going to do is continue my predecessor's priority, which was to focus on Alaska's rural airports. I'm going to work with the commissioner and our regional directors to make sure that we are adequately funding our maintenance and operations projects out there, especially those that have been deferred for a while. And really, the goal is to be good stewards of the capital improvements that we've made at many of these airports. I also intend to look at our prioritization process. And excuse me, I believe that we have and we will continue to focus on those airports with the greatest need. One of the greater challenges to our project prioritization process, though, is that we have a lot of FAA mandates. They define our requirements for the National Airport System airports, which include most of Alaska's airports, and also in many of our rural airports. And a couple of examples of that are the runway safety areas. You may have heard about that, but we spent roughly $230 million of our airport incentive program funding over the last 5 years just on runway safety areas around the state. And then the latest FAA mandate that seems to be of interest to them is our pavement condition, and so we've received a lot of pressure, I guess would be the right term, to focus on that. And what you'll see is that we'll probably spend between $40 and $50 million again of the AIP funding just on our pavements in the FY11 timeframe. Another example of how we are interacting with federal agencies is this 100 low lead aviation fuel issue. And right now we're involved in a joint departmental effort to respond to a proposed EPA rule change that will significantly impact Alaska's economy and really our way of life. And so we're going to be really focusing on that over the next couple of months. And ultimately, my goal is to work with those agencies to really provide a common sense approach to the way we deal with Alaska's airports so that we can continue to improve safety in our aviation community. Final area that I intend to focus on is communication, and this is one example of that, but really we're focused on communicating with both internal and external audiences. I've met with many key stakeholders already here in Alaska, including obviously the FAA, our Alaska Air Carriers Association, the Alaska Airports Association, Lakehood Advisory Group, and many others, and it's been really enjoyable to get to know those folks.
What you have as one of your handouts that I provided is a brochure that we've developed, and my intent with that is to try and concisely, yes, tell the Alaska aviation story, both within our international airport system, but also our rural airports.
Now,
my desire is...
copies of this?
We have plenty.
Okay,
yes.
So if anyone in the audience would like to pick one up, please feel free to do so.
Okay. And certainly my intention is to really try to get this message back out to the East Coast and to the folks that are the decision makers, especially those that are making decisions about our funding, so they understand just what aviation means to our communities in the rural areas.
Have you been afforded an opportunity to go back to Washington, D.C. and speak to the people that one if that happened yet?
I haven't yet. I'm looking forward to that opportunity,
okay.
But I haven't yet.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think as soon as that can happen, that would be helpful.
You bet. Well, finally, we'll continue to update our website and provide as many details as we can on the projects that are going on here in Alaska, as well as our aviation system plan. The last time that plan was updated was in 1996, and so we're currently 2 years into the new program, and we'll continue to provide you updates on that as they come available. I think this slide really kind of says it all, and it's in that handout, but it demonstrates that 82% of our communities are not near a road and are really dependent upon aviation as their sole source for their basic needs. Just to give you an idea of where we're talking as far as the span, and this is what I'll try to emphasize with folks who don't understand the size of Alaska, is that's Panama City, that's Duluth, Minnesota, and this is Blythe, California. So when folks, especially in the lower 48, begin to understand and relate to those distances, they'll see just what the kind of challenge that we're dealing with here in Alaska. I'd be remiss if I didn't plug our Gov Delivery, and it is a very good program that is a push program that can give you a lot of information about what's going on, certainly in our government. Well, I've tried to give you just a quick overview of the Alaska International Airport System, our rural airports, and then where I intend to concentrate my effort in the next few months as I take on this very exciting task as the new deputy for aviation. And with that, I'll open up to questions.
I was getting back to the FAA mandates. Do you feel there's a lot of mandates that FAA puts on that isn't really applicable to Alaska?
Well, I think that's the thing that we have to work with them on, because I would say that's probably true. I think there are, but it's airport dependent, and that's kind of the challenge, is to work through each of those issues, and look at the airports and the type of mandate that they're trying to apply to that, to see if it really makes sense.
And then of the 230 some state operated airports, as far as operation and maintenance, are we doing an okay job, or how do you feel about all the state-run airports out there?
Well, I think so 255 is the number today, but I think that's probably one of our biggest challenges is to really adequately use the funds that we're afforded to make sure that we're maintaining our runways at the level that ensures the margin of safety our pilots expect. But it's just a fact of life, within the budget that we're afforded. But I think our the folks that are working in those areas are doing a great job with what we're offering them.
And so then you feel comfortable our congressional delegation is doing all they can do to...
Well, we'll continue to work with them to, make sure that they are also...
I didn't mean that to be a political statement
at
all.
I understand. No, and they, I,
they understand this issue equally well, and so we'll...
Have you had an opportunity to meet with them? I know you didn't get back to Washington, D.C. yet, but...
Not in this position, no.
Okay. We'll have to make that happen.
Yeah.
I want to acknowledge on my left, I have Senator Kevin Myers, and welcome. We're very happy that you could join us today. So, and this is Mark Lucan in front of us at this point. He's our new deputy commissioner of aviation. So, and he had a wonderful introduction by our commissioner, Leo Von Schaven. So we're well on the road here to our meeting. So thank you very much. And do you have a question, Representative
thank
Johnson?
You, Minister, thank you. Mark, thank you, and thank you for coming. I appreciate your service to our country. You will very quickly learn, if you haven't already, that we have a very large general aviation population in the state. And the interaction between the international airport system, especially in Anchorage and Fairbanks, I think, where you have Lake Hood, small airport, as well as not guard anymore, but used to have guard activity there, but you have Elmendorf, and it's a very busy flyway, and it's a very critical area for general aviation. So have you looked at the relationship between general aviation and the 121 carriers, as well as the private pilots, as it reflects? Have you had a chance to deal into that? Because I know there's always that rub between the private pilot and the commercial entities, as well as the commercial carriers and the cargo carriers. And you've probably seen it's a very busy place out there, maybe unique in the world.
I think it is. You know, and I've actually gotten to fly around the Anchorage Bowl and been part of, you know, some of the general aviation approaches, as well as our, you know, our instrument approaches into Elmendorf. But, you know, I've gotten to see it in action, and as well as I've had a chance to meet with the Lake Hood Advisory Council. But to answer your question, I would say I probably haven't gotten as in-depth, or maybe haven't gotten a lot of feedback from the general aviation community yet. But I would say, again, having flown in this area here in the Anchorage Bowl, that while it is unique, I think we've done a really good job of separating aircraft with the procedures that we have in place, you know, that we've worked with the FAA and then the airports to make sure that we're keeping aircraft apart.
If I might, I would like to encourage you to get with the Pilots Association, and they typically are not going to say anything until there's a problem, and I would encourage you to reach out prior to that and open those lines of communication. They can be very vocal, and I'm sure everyone in this group has had calls from a pilot somewhere who's got some problem with something, and I think a third of the population of Alaska's licensed pilots. So it's a large contingency and constituency for us, as it is for you. So I encourage you to reach out, and as a private pilot yourself, I think you'd understand the necessity to do that. And I don't want to speak for them, but I think they have felt slighted in the past a little bit. And if you would extend that courtesy, I think it would behoove you and help me personally and many of the members here who have pilots in their district to... If you'd start that dialogue earlier as opposed to later, that would be very much appreciated.
To the chair, Representative Johnson, I will tell you that I have met with Tom George from AOPA, as well as Dee Hansen from the Alaska Airmen's Association. So I'm at least, you know, familiar with the folks from several of these associations, but I know that there are several others, and I will certainly make it my again, a priority, like you asked me to meet with them.
Okay. I had a question on the marketing topic. What would be your main carrot or attraction to go ahead with it, entice them with the cargo hub?
Well, I think the we've been working with U.S. Department of Transportation to really help interpret the transfer right rules that apply to Alaska that are different from the rest of the U.S. And what we hope that the cargo carriers will recognize is the huge potential that they have here in Alaska.
We recently heard that several of the international, the foreign international carriers really didn't understand what those rules meant to them. And so I think that's probably what we see as one of the biggest opportunities for those carriers to come into Anchorage, to move cargo around between aircraft, to actually maximize not only the amount of cargo they're carrying, but to really be efficient as to where it's going. And so, you know, coming from their suppliers, moving cargo around, and then to their distribution centers, we see that as a huge opportunity for them.
Gregory, I'm seeing a marketing tool like a 3-minute video or a 2-minute video, kind of futuristic, what it could be, and bringing in the Alaska Railroad and, you know, tying all that in, and then they can, and it's easy for us as legislators as well as our staff to pass those out, so they're very effective, and sometimes it takes 2 hours to shoot 3 minutes, but just a recommendation.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Okay, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And on those same lines, we have some unique federal laws as it relates to cargo transfer. Are there any state laws, duty-free areas that we're lacking in that as a body we could address to help that, expedite that, to make that more attractive for people to come and transfer it? Are there areas that you can see, and maybe you haven't had time to deal with, to get deep into that, but if there's something we could do to make it more attractive, and duty-free zones are the kind of the, I think, what a lot of people look at, and we're not paying duties if you just transfer, I understand that, but is there some way we could make that more enticing as an assembly area, as a state? So you may not know the answer, but be thinking in those terms of what you need for us to do statutorily to make Anchorage, Fairbanks, and all of our airports a more attractive location for carriers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Don Johnson, we'll definitely, I've got that as a note, and I can't answer that question right now, but we certainly will do that research and get back to you.
Thank you. And Mr. Loken, your first debut was perfectly wonderful, and we thank you. And we'll bring up Deputy Commissioner now, maybe.
Senator Menard?
Yes.
Yes, if I could follow up with the Deputy Commissioner.
Yes, please do. State your name for the record again, please.
Oh, this is Senator Joe Pascan.
Okay, thank you.
What I was focusing on, these 25 per week overflights, are they due to the jet fuel shortage, or are they due to something else? And that's in part of the overall question of, can we get them back? And then what volume do the 25 flights represent?
Through the Chair, Senator Pascan, I would tell you that we probably can't pinpoint exactly why they're overflying. But I would say that probably a portion of that has to do with fuel, what they perceive as fuel availability. So I guess probably part of our task will be to make sure that the word is out that fuel is available here in Alaska.
Do you know whether the imported jet fuel is cheaper?
Through the Chair, Senator Pascan, I don't know. My guess is no, only because it's we're paying a fee to bring it in. But again, I can't answer that adequately.
And then the last focus is as I understand, you indicate we're back to 2006 levels. Was 2008 the peak, or what year was the peak? And do we expect at any time in the near future to get back to a peak jet fuel consumption in the state?
Through the Chair, Senator Pascan, I think that's really going to be dependent upon the larger economy. You know, we would certainly hope to see that. See a peak, but again, it's really going to be dependent on the greater economy, especially in the Lower 48.
How far below the peak are we currently at? That's what I'm trying to figure out, as far as jet fuel volumes as far as statewide sales?
I'll have to bring my fuel expert back up. He can hopefully answer that question.
Through the chair, Senator Passban, the demand for jet fuel does vary seasonally, so it's not simply a year-to-year comparison, but also a seasonal comparison. We are currently back up at the levels that we were at in November, which in November of 2009, which is when we sort of reached a limit that we couldn't go above without getting at least some production from Tower Number 3. Now, Tower Number 3 has been turned on and is producing product now. So for the top of the peak season, July, August, the tourist season, plus a lot of cargo moving, we're probably in good shape for the next couple months. But that doesn't help an air carrier that wants to look at a plan through the winter into next summer. And it's that that lower demand period in the winter when we're concerned about the production decreasing more than the demand decreases. And to go back to your previous question, the carriers tell us, and this is anecdotal, that most of the 25 flights are due to fuel, and because of the payload range equation, they fully recognize that it is worth their while to stop in Alaska because they can carry more cargo and generate more revenue. So they all have expressed a desire to get those flights back into Alaska, and we want to make sure that we can help resolve this problem while they still have that desire and haven't changed their operations.
Senator Passban, do you have a follow-up?
What I'm trying to focus upon is what percentage or what volume does the imported jet fuel bear as relative to the Flint Hill Tower 3 capacity to produce? In other words, if that gets back to one of my initial price concerns, is the imported jet fuel cheaper for these 25 flights, or is in-state cheaper, but it just, we don't have enough demand for it?
Through the chair, Senator Passban, one of the problems is the carriers and the producers set their contracts and determine the price. That is not information that is made available to the airport. They guard that very closely because that is a competitive advantage of one airline over another. So it's very difficult for us to get information to speak specifically to the price of fuel. It may only vary a few pennies here and there, but if one carrier, because of their volume, can get a few pennies advantage over millions of gallons, that becomes very significant money. So I'm afraid we as the state and the airport have a difficult time speaking specifically to the price issue.
Well, let me follow up then on that issue. In other words, if the legislature were ever to be asked to fund storage capacity, then I think that the relevant issue is are we funding storage capacity for imported oil as compared to storage capacity for in-state produced jet fuel? And so, that's why I'm trying to develop this concept of what do we need to do to sustain availability of jet fuel, but I don't want to say that we're going to build storage capacity and then have it filled with imported jet fuel.
Through the chair, Senator Passban, that's certainly a legitimate concern. If we go back to the peak days of 2007, we were basically maximizing the capability of the in-state production in the state of Alaska. There virtually was no more jet fuel that could be produced by any of the in-state facilities. So at that point in time, if we were going to continue to grow, or if I look optimistically toward the future, when we get back to that level and want to grow above that, we will need additional storage capability to handle out-of-state product coming in to allow us to go past that threshold. Right now, there are concerns that if we had additional storage, the competition between the in-state production and the out-of-state import is an economic battle, and and that's decided on the business case, and the folks at Flint Hills do have some physics issues that are making their life more difficult.
Senator Passavant.
Thank you very much, Senator Menard. That's all I have at the moment.
Okay, and now we'll go to Representative Johnson. He has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And while we have the fuel guy in front of us, what impact are the 777s going to have?
That's through the Chair, Representative Johnson. Thank you for that question. There has been a lot of weeping and wailing about the death of the Alaska International Airport system because of the 777. And if you read back in the newspapers many years ago, that same cry went out when the 747 was first produced because airplanes were no longer going to land here. I'm happy to say that virtually every 747 on the planet does come through our airport system. The 777 does have the capability to overfly us, and depending on the business model of the carrier, if they volume out before they weight out in their airplane, they can overfly us and go to Louisville, Memphis, Chicago, Atlanta, cities in the lower 48. If the 747 reaches its maximum weight for cargo or for total weight, it cannot overfly us and go to those places and still needs to make a stop. So in large part, it depends on what they're carrying as to whether or not they can overfly. We do know that the FedEx business model, as they're currently operating, does allow them to overfly eastbound. And that gives them an advantage of being able to stay on the ground in Asia a few more hours and then fly directly to Memphis. Interestingly enough, on the westbound flight, empty but flying into a headwind, the 777 often stops here because the length of the flight is too long for one crew to do, and they have to stop here and change crews even though they're empty. So the 777 changes the situation a little bit, but it is not a drastic, immediate impact on the airports. There are a lot of 747s that will be hauling cargo, and as the 777 gets into heavier weights, we anticipate seeing them here too.
Thank you. Thank you for answering my FedEx question that I was so interested in. Okay, thank you very much, both of you, and we sure. Is there any other questions before we let them off the hook? Okay, thank you. Then next we will go to our Deputy Commissioner, Frank Richards from DOT. We're so honored that you skipped golf today to come and share with us. Oh, it's a private joke.
You may just have a later tea time.
Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Menard. For the record, Frank Richards, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I appreciate the ability to come to this assembly today and be able to address questions. I did not prepare a specific presentation, and I'm here to just answer any questions that you may have of the operations other than aviation.
Are there any questions? And of course, as you know, we're focused on aviation. So, so far, just give us a short couple sentences on how you feel in your leadership role with the new. Well, that's kind of unfair to put Mark on the spot, but you know how it's going from your perspective.
Senator Mark Menard, we've had a very challenging year over the last year with the stimulus monies that came into the state of Alaska, not only for aviation, but for highway and transit. And I'm proud to say that the department has responded in kind and been able to take those monies that were provided to us, put them out onto the street, and get that work under construction. We have projects ranging from Ketchikan to Kotzebue to Anchorage, and we are all seeing the results of that. And I guess what I find most beneficial is the results being reported to us by the public, and that is that the public is calling in not with negative comments but with positive comments. Specifically in the Anchorage Bowl, we saw the paving of Minnesota, and with the Glen Highway, with the work that will be completed this year, we'll have paved out from essentially downtown Anchorage to downtown Palmer. So that represents a significant asset improvement for the commuters coming into Anchorage from the Mat-Su and provides a better, safer driving system for them. The commissioner, and on his daily commute coming in from Big Lake, gets to experience that as well, and I can tell you as a fellow office mate. He comes in generally most mornings with a smile because he now has a good commute to drive on. So I'm pleased to see that. The community of Kotzebue, with the work that's being done on Front Street, is now seeing an area that was a safety concern for them because it was an area of high erosion and traffic. And now with the work that's being done out there to expand Front Street, we're seeing the erosion being taken care of and an asset being provided to the community, which will provide for safer vehicular transportation, but also for the boating community that uses the Front Street access for subsistence and commercial fishing operations. We received as a state this year additional monies in our federal highway program. Approximately $130 million was available to the state to use for projects within the STIP. That combined with the additional $276 million that we got in our projects last year represents nearly $400 million the state has and will have to put to use to address transportation issues across the state that we had not planned on. With that comes a very aggressive timeline placed on us by the Federal Highway and Aviation Administrations to obligate and use those funds. And again, I will say that the department staff, working the diligent long hours, has and is meeting those obligation challenges. So Alaska will see the benefits of those projects over the next couple of years as they are bid out and constructed. So from that perspective, it's been an aggressive and challenging year, but we were able to put the money that are being provided to us to good use.
Okay, thank you. We have a question here from Senator Myers, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good to see you again. It is a nice day for golf, though. I hope you get out later on. Just a couple questions, and they're not airport-related, so I hope it's okay with the chairman. I periodically get asked, again, about what we're doing different for the new Seward Highway, you know, the deaths and the traffic accidents that we've had there in previous summers have been unacceptable, and having just gone down to Girdwood last week, there is a lot of traffic, and obviously a lot of people are taking their boats down, going fishing, etc. And I was wondering if maybe you could update us on what, if anything, we're doing differently on the new Seward, in particular from Potter's Marsh down to Hope or even Portage Glacier, where all the tourists and boaters seem to head. And then second, you brought up the commute from Big Lake, which then reminds me of the Kinnick Arm Bridge. And I frankly just haven't heard anything about that in years and years, and maybe that's a good thing. But if you could just briefly update me on those two big projects, that would be helpful as we respond to our constituents.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer.
Change of topic here. Okay. Rose.
Let me start on, if I may, on the highway safety corridors. Through legislation the past couple years ago, it allowed the department transportation along with the Department of Public Safety to designate highway safety corridors where we see high incidence of fatalities and high incidence of traffic accidents, major injury traffic accidents. We have four currently: the Parks Highway from Wasilla to Big Lake, the Seward Highway from Potter down to just south of Girdwood, the Sterling Highway in the Sterling area, and then Kinnegoose Bay in the Wasilla area. Those areas with the legislation allows us to put in place three efforts. We call them the three E's: engineering, enforcement, and education. So the department is using highway safety grant money to be able to support a new division within the Department of Public Safety called the Bureau of Highway Patrol. That is now funding new officers and new patrol vehicles to work those highway safety corridors specifically for the enforcement actions. Last year, we saw the deaths occur on the Seward Highway. We are now in the season of high traffic on the Seward Highway in particular. It, unlike the Parks Highway, sees a seasonal fluctuation where the traffic goes up to almost 24,000 vehicles a day. The Parks Highway has routinely 18 to 20,000 vehicles a day, so it's a year-long issue. But specifically on the Seward Highway, the Bureau of Highway Patrol has put in place, and I believe actually stationed in Girdwood, new officers to patrol that section of the road. We've put in place the education program. You may have seen commercials or heard the advertisements on the radio about don't drive distracted, don't drive drunk, click it or ticket. Many of those safety-related programs that we have put in place over the last few years to try and educate folks to slow down. You're going to get there just at the same rate of speed if you drive the speed limit as if to try and to drive at a faster rate. Don't pass on double yellow lines. Drive safely. We can't legislate, unfortunately, what goes on inside the driver's mind, but we can try and give them the information to make smart and wise decisions. DOT also received this year $5 million from the legislature, general fund, to be able to initiate more projects within the highway safety areas. Those softer, or I'll say less costly, projects that may influence driver behavior, whether they be more signage, whether they be arrows or markings that will help drivers know that they are in highway safety corridors, and if there are intersections or other appurtenances that we can add to at a smaller dollar volume, that's what we're designing right now. The long-term goal on those highway safety corridors is to expand from two-lane to four-lane highways. The project cost to be able to do that is extremely expensive. The project from Willow or Wasilla to Big Lake is in excess of $110 to $120 million. The four-lane on the Seward Highway, if we were ever to build it, with the challenges of a park and a national forest on the uphill side, a railroad and the beluga critical habitat on the water side, is in excess of $600 million. That's money that we don't currently have available to us to address just that section of road on that particular highway. So education, we're out there providing that information to the drivers, to kids in school so they can help influence their parents when they're on the road, enforcement with the Bureau of Highway Patrol, and then engineering to try and design those near-term projects that we can put into place while we plan, program, and acquire money to do the other projects, such as Winding Corridor on the Seward Highway. When you talk about Kibata, Senator Menard was recently appointed to the Kibata Board, replacing Senator Huggins, who was a longstanding member of that board. I can tell you personally, my involvement with Senator Menard, she has been a proponent of the Kinnickarm Bridge and Access Bridge Project for many years, and I appreciate that. Excuse me?
I drug you out there.
That's right. I have had the pleasure of going to the Matsu Port, having been also photographed and put into her newsletter, which I am honored to be. The Kinnickarm Bridge is has finished up their latest environmental biological assessment of the belugas under the Endangered Species Act to be able to get to a record of decision. The Federal Highway Administration asked that the project develop that biological assessment that will then be given to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for them to do a biological opinion. Those two formal processes must be complete before the Federal Highway Administration then comes up with a record of decision for the project. That is the most critical path that the project is on right now. The executive director has asked me to go back to D.C. with him later next month to be able to address the issues with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because in addition to the Endangered Species Act, there's also the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which is also a responsibility of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So in that case, we have one agency but two different laws that they are now having to work through to provide their opinions on the impacts of the bridge on the beluga and the critical habitat in Upper Cook Inlet. So that project is poised, ready to go forward, and is just waiting for the essentially the work efforts of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to complete.
And if I can inject and add to that too, if everything goes and we get the record of decision and everything goes like we hope it will, by 2015 we actually would have the bridge built. So with the public partnership and stuff that we're working on. So it's very, very encouraging at this point. It's never been more encouraging for me as a citizen out in the valley. When my husband moved me out there 40 years, he said, "Don't worry, Linda, there'll be a bridge going across in a couple years." So, yeah, it's an encouraging, and I want everybody to consider it an Alaska legacy, not a Matsu project or, you know, this battle between the port and Point McKenzie, because I'm very encouraged. So thank you for agreeing to go back with Andrew, too. Any other follow-up with him?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one. I could resist asking Frank about roads. Since
well, when you have an expert at the table, we have to take advantage of him. Thank you very much, Frank.
If, Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Pascavan.
Thank you. Just one question. Deputy Commissioner Richards was talking about the road projects and all of that, and what my question was is, where would Alaska be at now without the federal stimulus dollars in its projects?
Through the chair, Senator Pascavan, Alaska receives nearly $400 million annually from the Federal Highway Administration to address our highway and road projects across the state. We have received that money, even though the Safety Lou project, Safety Lou authorization expired in September of 2009. We're in continuing resolutions until Congress is able to address and provide for a new authorization. It does not look like that's going to happen in 2010. It's likely they'll wait till after the elections in 2011 to be able to take up that next legislation. Our congressional delegation is certainly monitoring it, as we are within the state, and we are we're ready to respond once we see an actual language coming in. What that has meant to us, though, is that under the continuing resolutions, we're continuing to get the same amount of money as we had in federal fiscal year 2009. Which is
my question was focused upon the stimulus dollars. And I don't know whether that was directly an answer to the stimulus funds.
Through the chair, Senator Pascavan, no, that was specifically addressing the issue of our regular federal highway program. The stimulus dollars were above and beyond our regular program and helped us out greatly in terms of our pent-up backlog of projects. We still have literally billions of dollars worth of needs out there across our state, both in our rural system and in our urban system. So we have our federal dollars to rely on. We have the individual appropriations that the legislature gives us for road projects around the state, and the stimulus dollars were, again, icing on top of that cake.
And approximately how much in federal stimulus money is in the works right at this construction season?
Through the chair, Senator Pascavan, we had the requirement of the stimulus dollars to have that obligated by the fall of last year. That money has got to be spent by 2011, and so those projects are in place and underway right now to meet that target timeline.
And how much money?
We had we received approximately $275 million into the state for stimulus for airports, highways, and transit.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Senator Pascavan. Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you very much.
This is Peggy Wilson, and I have one question. Sorry.
Okay. We'll back to sit in the chair. Go ahead, Peggy.
Thank you very much. Frank, with us making adjustments to the STIP, and also with the money that we're looking at that has come in, what is the difference as far as are we going to just have to be able to just do the STIP projects, or what about the other projects that have kind of been waiting for quite some time? What does it look like?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, again, with the stimulus monies that came in addition to the additional monies that we received this year with the Safety Lou authorization, that has advanced projects that have been waiting for funding in the STIP. Again, a project that is going to use federal highway dollars must actually be part of the STIP. That is part of the Title 23 requirements, and that project must have been developed using the federal highway procedures. That's the environmental procedures, the right-of-way certification, and our design processes. So that means that we have pushed projects that likely wouldn't have been funded in 11, or would have likely have been funded in 11 or 12, and we've moved them up into 9 and 10. So it's brought those projects forward, which has helped tremendously to be able to do more work than we had originally planned based on our regular program.
So, follow-up?
Yes.
The stimulus money, even though that was kind of a different pot of money, that still is considered federal money, and so it still has to be in the STIP?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that is correct. The monies came to us through the Federal Highway Administration, so we had to follow all of those Title 23 requirements.
Okay, thank you. So then, a follow-up? Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Wilson, go ahead.
That allowed us then to do a few projects that were totally state-funded, which allowed us to do them quicker than we normally would, and also cheaper than we normally would, which also made a difference in the time. How many of those projects were made possible?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the stimulus dollars, again, funded projects that had been developed using the federal processes. So they were federally funded projects that required, well, actually the stimulus did not require state match. Our regular program requires a match. So we were able to advance, I believe it's between 15 and 20 highway-related projects with the stimulus funds that came to Alaska.
Okay, thank you.
Do you have an adequate answer, Representative Wilson? Are you okay?
Yes, I'll follow up later.
And you have a follow-up?
Nope.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, if I can address any specific questions you may have later, please feel free, give me a call, or I'd be glad to talk to you anytime.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Okay, thank you again. And we'll have now Wasilla Mayor Vern Ruprecht come forward, please, on what are we going to do for Wasilla Airport, topic of my own to my heart.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the time given to me to come in here. Not to be rather parochial or regional, what Wasilla is attempting to do now is we essentially, as the Chair knows, at the Menard Sports Arena, the center, that is our FEMA area. And some of us have lived through a couple disasters in that valley, and it's become critical with the population surge out there. So we're trying to get the 0.9 mile from South Mac Road over to the airport for four significant reasons. One, so we can have the connectivity to the airport for supply, resupply, and air evacuation out to the FEMA center in the event of an emergency. Two, to develop the economic area out there. Right now you have to drive 1.5 miles up the Parks Highway and then 1.5 miles or more back into the airport, and so don't my police officers, just to patrol it and then go back out of the city to come back in the city. So it makes it very difficult, you know, for no connectivity with the city out there. At this juncture, besides that being able to serve FEMA, we can also do economic development out there. We do have money in the pot to begin the railroad station move to get it out of downtown Wasilla, because as the Department of Transportation people are fully aware, it's critical with that railroad coming through the middle of the city, and it's probably going to stay there many more decades. It's stopping in the city is an unworkable thing between Kennecoose Bay Road, the George Parks Highway, and Main Street. We want to put our train station and eventually the commuter out of the airport area. It'll also open up all the economic development out there. In the last year, I've got back with the FAA. We have a 3,700-foot runway. We're moving it up to 4,400 feet. If we can get the road connectivity, we can move the hill. We have the material to put at the end of our runway. The FAA, we're going to an upgraded navigation system. In the past, that had been discussed, we're online now to do the survey, to bring that to ground nav through the GPS system. We have airports out in the valley that permit it. Wasilla doesn't. Has a 700-foot ceiling. Why that's critical to us is we have on the ground right now a DC-3 company that moved out of Anchorage that wants to do its maintenance in Wasilla. It's easier and cheaper for them. They can fly in a light and take care of their maintenance there. We also have a helicopter company attempting to come into Wasilla. There's a lot of things going on. We also have the property available to bring in a warehousing operation like a Costco or a Sam's Club. Why would that be critical to the airport? Because everybody knows people buy in bulk for their fish camps, their operations in the bush, and everything else here in Anchorage. They take it to Merrill Field or their Bed Stevens Airport. It's a whole operation to do it. We do have small carriers in Wasilla. Once we get wholesale bulk sales out there, which we will, then those people just run it to the Wasilla Airport for light cargo coming out of Wasilla. And with the upgrade of the navigation and the lengthening of the airport runway, it can be more than sufficient to do that. And the fact of the matter is, everybody's well aware, is the population surge is going to the valley. And with it, we better be prepared to take care of it, not only with in order to take care of our citizens out there in an emergency, but also to take care of the air transportation needs and road transportation needs within the local area. What we're attempting to do out there, and as the chair is well aware, there's a tremendous amount of commuters to the slope that come out of the valley area. It's an hour into the city, Ted Stevens International Airport, long park and ride, flight out. Once we upgrade out there in the Wasilla area, we should be able to handle commuter out of that city. One of the difficulties with the Palmer Airport, and without the Palmer mayor, I think I take this opportunity to take a hit at him. Palmer suffers from those high shear winds, as everybody's well aware, plus the Chugach Mountain Range. We don't really have that problem in Wasilla. It's a much more clear airspace. Now, if we didn't have the population surge out there, we wouldn't be looking down the road as this is a critical thing, and we're coming to critical mass at this time. Transportation did identify the Kinnick Goose Bay Road as a very dangerous corridor, and believe me, I drive it a lot, and it is a dangerous corridor. The Borough Assembly is going to allow coal hauling trucks now coming down out of the Sutton area. It's getting more and more busy. And we're going to definitely and definitively need upgrades. I mean, if Kinnick Goose Bay Road can be described, it is a road to nowhere at this point. But it does go somewhere, to the port. We will see that in the future, but it goes out to a prison, and it'll go out to a port to offload coal. And so we're moving in that direction. So we all, besides roadways, which were significant to us, our airport's going to be significant in the future. We moved it out of downtown Wasilla, as the chair recalls, many years ago, for just this reason, because Wasilla has become more of an urban hub than it had ever been 15 or 20 years ago. And so if we don't get the connectivity from the Menard area from South Mac Road in so we can develop up, then we're going to be stuck in a bad situation within the next decade where it's become crowded. We're going to need the air transportation corridor and a better highway corridor through there, so that we can move cargo and transport people in and out of that locality. And so the city of Wasilla is planning forward. And I would like to invite the new deputy commissioner to perhaps find some time on his very busy schedule to come talk to our airport advisory commission. In the last year, I've managed to get one of the chief FAA communication chiefs is now on my commission. And so isn't a local attorney who does economic development, who's come on board by the name of Cameron Sherrick. And we're looking forward to it because they're bringing a whole new vibrance rather than being fixed-wing old airmen talking about light planes. They're talking about commercial development at this point. We just rezoned three large parcels to the south side of the airport as industrial. And a lot of people want to see that move, but we've got to get the roadway connectivity on 9/10 of a mile. Once we do that, it's anybody's guess when Katie bar the door.
And just speak to, for a minute, how did the capital budget affect the aviation plans this past year?
Well, we didn't get anything for that. So I've gone to the national delegation. We have some money in the bucket. But in order for Mr. Giddings, the public works director, to get that thing complete, that roadway, which is only 9/10 of a mile, to connect the airport to downtown, to the FEMA center, will be large enough to taxi aircraft to the FEMA area when necessary. And then it'll give connectivity directly into the airport complex.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you.
You have all the right people. It's like a staff meeting here of the commissioners, top-notch people to hear all this. So we're really appreciative that you came in today. Is there any questions or concerns from committee members? Senator Meyer?
Yes, I do. Thank you for joining us today, and I agree the whole valley is growing like crazy, and the infrastructure isn't keeping up, and we need to focus on more attention out in that area. But I know one of the concerns was, again, kind of going back to the bridge, that until we get the bridge built or get people to accept it and fund it, that we would have a ferry system back and forth. And again, that's one of those projects that I, frankly, just have lost track of what the status is of that. I know we built a ferry down in Ketchikan, yeah, but I don't know when that's going to come up here and actually be in service.
Well, through the chair, Senator Meyer, thank you for the question. To the best of my knowledge at this time, the ferry is complete. It is going to be stored in Southeast until such time as it can come up here. Our problem is docking facilities on this side of the bay. Until we get that resolved, and that's a borough issue, not a city of Wasilla issue in particularly, the ferry is complete and done. We have a docking facility over there, but nowhere to put it on this side. Anybody's guess. Notwithstanding that fact, it's not stopping the population surge to the valley, no matter what we do. In fact, what we're finding is the Chamber of Commerce in Wasilla did a little bit of a study on it. We're getting reverse shopping out there now. People are leaving here going out there, even though they're paying a small sales tax. They prefer to go to the environment and be in the valley on weekends and do the shopping, which I find kind of interesting. Where, if you recall, 20, 30 years ago, when people emigrated to Alaska, they landed in Fairbanks or Anchorage, and then they would strike out within a year or two. They're coming in directly to Wasilla from the States, something we've never seen before. You know, I've talked to a lot of people out there, and you can look at the DMV records in Palmer. They're immigrating into Alaska, and they're bypassing Anchorage or Fairbanks. They're going directly to Wasilla in particularly, or the greater area. So we've got a lot of things we've got to plan for in the future. And as a lot of people want to live that more rural lifestyle, excuse me, what they have to understand is they're not on the countryside out there anymore. And my only suggestion to them is stop making kids, but we know that's not going to happen. So, I mean, we have to be prepared for that bang, and we're already getting hit. We're getting clobbered with it now. I mean, I've lived in Wasilla after I left Muldoon in 83. It was mostly dirt roads. And the George Parks Highway was two lanes. And if anybody's been out there recently, I mean, it is a traffic choke at least three times a day through the Wasilla area. And with all deference to the commissioner out there, too big lake. So he's well aware of it. And there's no else way around it. And Kinnickus Bay Road connects up to Point Mac Road, and then it ends at the port. And then there's a back road called Burma Road that takes you back the other way, but that's certainly not a commuting road. And the people are moving out there. They're just moving there, period.
A lot of the military are moving.
Right. And because they get more housing for lesser dollars, it's a more open, you know, environment. I lived in Anchorage quite a number of years, and it hemmed in, and it's getting worse. And I lived in Muldoon when that was a two-lane road. So we all seen the changes, and it's the dynamics of people moving in on us, which we're welcome, but that's the way it is.
Thank you, good mayor. We have a question. Do you have a follow-up, Senator Mayor?
Nope.
We have a question from Senator Davis.
You talked a lot about all the projects and all the things that you need to happen and what you want to happen, but I'd like to know what your highest priorities and what are you doing to get to the point to reach that goal?
Well, Senator Davis, it's good to see you again. I haven't seen you since you were at the sports arena last year sharing a sandwich with me. One of our top priorities right now is to get the connectivity on South Mac Road over to the sports arena, which is, you know, it's actually taking off. There's an awful lot more of bookings in there. It's become a very busy place. We've asked, which has been on our wish list for quite a while. We put it on the federal and the state wish list, and we got no action. I know there's a lot of projects around us that need attention, but we also know what our hub area problems are. And I think probably my being here today can bring home the attention to the other districts, the representatives of other parts of the state, that the Wasilla area and the borough, especially the lower end, is becoming a very crowded place. Now, the upgrades to the Glen Highway are needed, but, and we also know a lot of money went into the upgrades of the Parks Highway not that many years ago, and they're still working on it. But as you stand out by the roadway and you see it bumper to bumper, we know that, you know, there's no way out of it. I think that Deputy Commissioner Richards indicated 24,000 cars a day are coming through the corridor. And I know the Senator's been out there, and hopefully he didn't get held up in our traffic jams too long. But they're certainly getting worse. And I think by Senator Menard inviting me here today, we can start the process of bringing to the state legislators and those key commissioners what the real problems are in the core area of the borough, and particularly Wasilla, is it's the hub as it's spreading out. I mean, Palmer is a smaller town. It sits off on the Glen Highway. It hasn't grown the way Wasilla has. And so, knowing it's a key city, right now it's the fifth largest city, still the fastest growing, and if we were to incorporate the population out to Settlers Bay and Connect Goose Bay Road, to Hollywood Vine area that cuts back over, and I know you're familiar with just south of us, I think our population would put us at the third largest city in the state overnight. And that's how critical it's become.
Thank you, Madam President. We do have Deputy Commissioner in the room. I wonder if they want to address any of the issues that you just spoke to now, rather than setting the meeting up for later. Well, I don't want to put anybody on the spot. I just want to hear the comments that might be made on why, how you could get that 0.9 mile that you need to be completed. You didn't get a federal state funding this time around.
No,
I don't know what other avenues you have of getting the funds. But is there anybody in the room to speak to that?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't want to put Frank Richards on the spot. I'm sorry, Senator Davis, he's a nice guy.
I think that is a fair question. And the only thing is I would ask if you would just hold off in interest of time, and there are some people here that need to get back to the Valley, and then we'll come back to this before we close the meeting. Is that fair enough? We'll come back. Can you? We just put those on hold. Is that okay, Senator Davis? Okay, let's do that. So thank you very much,
thank you,
Mayor of Wasilla.
Thank you, panel, committee members.
Next, it's my honor and privilege to bring forward Joe Griffith, and at this point, maybe Cheryl Hines, would you come and give us a little bio of your good friend Joe, and so we can all enjoy. We know he's a very accomplished person, but let's zero in here on this new Build a Plane program.
Thank you very much, Senator Menard, and other members of the committee. It's always a pleasure to talk to our legislature.
And I'm going to interrupt you right there and welcome Representative Jay Ramos, who's looking very tanned and healthy these days. welcome. Okay. Sorry for that interruption. Go ahead.
Senator Menard, my name is Joe Griffith. I'm General Manager of Matanuska Electric. I have with me Cheryl Hines, who is my community affairs person, and we're going to give you a brief sketch of this Build a Plane project that Cheryl did a lot of the legwork on. In essence, Matanuska Electric provided a facility in Talkeetna. We've guaranteed them 3 years. And the airplane has been provided.
I'm sorry, is that rent-free for 3 years?
I have the right to. I'm the boss. I'll set the stage for it. We've provided a facility in Talkeetna and an airplane. We didn't provide the airplane. I did. And Cheryl can give you the details on how she, how this all came about. So, Cheryl, it's over to you.
Good morning. I had a little fun little story here, and Joe already kind of gave part of it away, so that's why I was saying hang on there.
We like stories. Go ahead.
You like stories? Good. Well, first of all, not to compete with Colonel Lukin, but those of us out at MEA, we just have to toot our boss's horn, and that is that we also have a colonel as a GM, and flew three tours in Vietnam, and taught at Fighter Weapons School, was Wing Commander here in Elmendorf. So, which brings me to about two or three months ago, a woman called me from Talkeetna and told me she was a pilot for K2 Aviation and Alaska Airlines. And so that caught my attention. She said she had a project she wanted to introduce us to. It was called Build a Plane. Well, I kind of scratched my head at that. And then she said she needed two things to get it going. One was a large building, and one was an airplane. So at that, I thought, well, gosh, you need to meet our general manager, because we might have a building, and we just might be able to find you an airplane. So we met, had dinner, and basically, I'll give you an overview of the project. It Build a Plane, which we call BAP, is a 501c formed to teach the disciplines of math and science to kids, particularly kids that might have an interest in aviation as a career. And to back up a little bit, the woman, Rebecca Fisher, is a beautiful young woman. At a time in her life around, say, 14, 15, around in there, she lost her way just a little bit and hopped on an airplane, a private plane, fell in love with aviation, and totally turned her life around. So that's why her passion for Build a Plane is to help kids out in particularly Talkeetna, that area, because she lives there, and it's a natural hub for the climbers on McKinley and sightseeing. So she has incorporated the support of around 20 volunteers from the airport around Talkeetna, from the pilots, the ANPs, and the owners of the air taxis. So they're on this project in full support. FAA is a partner with them, with Build a Plane, as is Snap-on Tools, who provide the tools at a 50% off their prices. We do have FedEx and UPS are also on board. They help move the airplane from, say, point A to the project. Say if a kid in Kansas City wants to do a Build a Plane, the Build a Plane Corporation will find an airplane, and UPS and FedEx will move that airplane and donate it to the Kansas City site. Here we were lucky we didn't need that. We have two projects in Alaska right now, Hooper Bay and Talkeetna. If you'll notice in your handouts in the back page, you'll see the building that MEA owns, which is 30 feet from K2 Aviation in Talkeetna. And it is absolutely perfect for building an airplane. So after looking at our insurance and talking to our board and our GM bringing this forward, we donated this building to the kids for, as Joe says, for 3 years to build their airplane. I think the most impressive thing is we have the backing of the school board. they have incorporated in this coming fall's curriculum Introduction to Aviation. So the kids can now take Introduction to Aviation, and then they can go to our building and learn how to actually build an airplane. The beautiful part of this project is that our GM on his own donated a ground loop Stinson. And, excuse me, I've got laryngitis a little bit. The beauty of that airplane is that it's canvas and metal, which is good for teaching, good for the AMPs, good for the kids. So, circling back to a couple months ago when Rebecca called me and told me about this project and said she needed two things, then the fit with MEA and our GM was an absolute hand in glove. We're very proud of this project. The national president of Build a Plane came up about a month ago, wonderful man from Oregon, and he started this just because he thought there's a better way to teach math and science to kids, and of course he's a pilot. So I think this is a win-win for everyone, and we're very proud to be here before you presenting this project.
Thank you very much. Any questions from committee members? Anyone online? Senator Pasvan, Representative Wilson?
No questions at this time, but thank you for the opportunity.
Go ahead, please, Joe.
I was just simply thank you for the opportunity. Again, we think it's of value to the kids, and we're happy to be part of it. Thank you.
This is Representative Peggy Wilson. I think it's very exciting, and I'm very anxious to see if the difference. It's kind of hard to say a before and after, but if they're learning mathematics through this, it would be fun to be able to test to see how much they learn, but that's probably not too possible. I don't know.
Senator Menard, Representative Wilson, I think that's the intent. Once this becomes a formal class, that they will apply the mathematics and science associated with aviation to how it works in the real world. And I assure you that project we gave them will take plenty of effort in that vein, because the airplane was totally disassembled in boxes, so they can start from the ground up.
Wow.
And, excuse me, through the chair, Representative Wilson, you also might be interested in looking at this in your area.
Yeah, sounds wonderful.
Thank you. Well, the reason I wanted Build a Plane to come forward so I could share it with fellow committee members is, per capita, we have the most private pilots in the United States, and what better place to introduce new curriculum than in our wonderful state of Alaska. So I'm just thrilled to have read that. Actually, I read it through the newsletter, through MEA's newsletter. So with my capable staff, we got on it right away, and we thank you very much, sort of last-minute notice to come and make this presentation. So at least, everything's in education. We've got it out there now, and again, thank you very much for the time out of your precious day. I know you're very busy with all that's going on there, so thank you very much.
You're
welcome.
Okay, now maybe Mr. Frank Richards leave us, or Mary, are you going to fetch him? I guess that's a bad word to say about a commissioner, fetch him, but
there
he is.
Commissioner, Madam Chair, it's okay to fetch Deputy Commissioner.
I know I always elevate you to that, and that's not fair to the Commissioner Von Chaven. He's really the top dog, but, come in. Please sit down again. And we, Senator Davis, we will readdress those questions and concerns that you had on the issue of funding not being available, and is the Department of Transportation paying attention to that little bit of road. My concern is with, I'm sure, most of us, when we're almost at 90,000 people out in the valley, there is no commercial planes that can be zipping in and out to the North Slope, and therefore, if it's just a small fix, and I know roads cost so much a mile, I'm very aware of that, but you heard the questions that Senator Davis had asked prior to me deferring to build a plane, people. Okay, would you go ahead then? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Again, Frank Richards, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. The mayor and I had a very nice conversation in the hall during the last presentation.
That always happens. Why does that always happen?
Essentially, DOT, as I learned about this project during the last legislative session, and to learn really that the department had been communicating with the city about the needs not only at the airport but in to the connecting road for the airport. When asked about what can DOT do about it, it's really has the city originally nominated that project to the department for project funding. As you heard me talk previously, we have literally billions of dollars worth of needs on existing roads throughout the state of Alaska. When we have a new road coming in, it has to compete against those existing needs. It has to compete, be nominated and compete against those criteria that address safety-related issues. Economic activities is one of the criteria that we use to score our projects, funding levels, contribution by the local communities, etc. So a new road, unless there's specific general fund appropriation to be able to address that new road, doesn't score well under our existing federal highway funding program. So that's what I believe, without knowing a great detail about how the department has treated this road, that it probably hasn't risen to the level of a STIP-level project because it is not doesn't meet that criteria very well. But well, I'm certainly willing to work with the community to address what the needs are and to be able to see how we can best help them through the process.
But with the safety, it is a FEMA headquarters that certainly should ultimately gain us on the scorecard as... But anyway, I guess that's for another day in argument. But so, Senator Davis, did you want anyone?
I'll accept the information that he gave, but I still think there's further work to be done by the mayor. He talked about all these outstanding people he just got on his board. There must be other alternatives other than just state funding. I don't know if you're looking into those areas or...
To address the question, Senator Davis, through the chair, yes, I've spoke with both Congressman Young's office and Senator Murkowski, and so they're trying to assist us with that. We do have some funds in the kitty to do some of the work, but not get it completed through there. So Senator Murkowski is attempting to get us $1 million more towards it. Interestingly enough, I mean, we brought it forward to her, not only for economic development, but it's a FEMA center. I think it's its key priority. Without the connectivity to that airport, it kind of defeats the purpose where it's sitting. I mean, for those of us that fondly remember the high wind storms of the 70s, which literally shut that valley down and a lot of this city. And then, of course, we had the Big Lake Fire. We had people to house, people to feed. For those that have been in the Menard Memorial Center, we got the kitchen completed the last year on FEMA dollars. You could feed 2 Army regiments out of there now. We could easily house 600 people. And with the amount of people in the valley now, we've had power outages last winter with high winds. And people are looking, where do we go? And we were directing them over to the Menard Center because we have showers, cots, independent power, not as much as we need, but we brought generation up when I came on as mayor because I thought you can't have a FEMA center without diesel storage and generation, which we've got now. So we can't run all the lights, but we can cook food, keep the place warm, and house people, and keep the water going. But in order, if we have a really bad disaster, we have no way of evacuating or getting resupply if the roads shut down. And the only thing we can depend on then is air transportation in and out of the city at that point. God forbid we have a massive earthquake like 64. Because that certainly will cause all kinds of havoc in the city of Anchorage. And certainly, we're well aware of the fact a lot of people will evacuate in that direction. And so, we're going to be loaded up in the valley. And we're just hoping to be ready.
Mr. Richards.
Madam Chairman, One thing that comes to mind is, again, Deputy Commissioner Lucan talked about the projects like Accutan, and we've had projects where, on the highway side, where we've had multiple funding sources. That may be one of the best things that we can do to work with the community on, is looking at the Federal Aviation Administration fund options, the federal transit options that are available, and then potentially federal highway and general fund dollars. So it's going to take probably those multifaceted approach to be able to accomplish that project, and we're glad to work with the city on assisting them.
That's good. We appreciate that, Madam Chair. We do know the FAA won't put road money down. We've already checked that avenue. Okay. So they'll put down runway, but not road money.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chairman,
we'll go to Representative Rammers. Go ahead, Mr. Richards.
If I may, Madam Chairman, just to give Representative Rammers and Senator Paskin, we have been informed that a crane operating on the Barnett Street Bridge in Fairbanks toppled this morning about 11 a.m. During the construction of that bridge. Sounds like the operator came out unscathed, a little banged up, but that's a major accident that occurred on the project. We aren't sure why the crane failed, but it did, and just to let the committee know that accident occurred just this morning.
I'm sorry to hear that, Representative Ramos.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for having me. I apologize that I was late this morning, and God should take care of the people that are on that crane. But we're hopeful. We had that crane accident, you remember, in Juneau in the state capitol on the crossway, and there was one of the people they thought was not very seriously injured initially, then became injured. So hopefully there's no loss of life or quality of life that is a result of that. Madam Chair, the question I had is we're all reasonably familiar with the reappropriations for projects, and I'm trying to remember the name of that $17 million community that's getting a new runway that made the paper where 20 people live there or something. And
that's in Senator Hoffman's district, correct?
Yeah, yes, for whom I couldn't have any more respect than for my good friend Senator Hoffman. That being said, however, I am interested in what our U.S. Senate is capable of doing in trying to reapprope some highway funds out of that $17 million project to try and figure out how to help an airport in Wausau. I've been in Wausau a lot. There's a lot of human beings down there.
That's a good thing.
It's a great thing, and there are not very many in that airport that's getting $17 million. And, is there any elasticity that our Senate delegation in D.C. has to reappropriate money to finish that other project with over a several-year cycle and move some money into the Valley to address the concerns that Mayor Ruppreit has brought up today? And I'm addressing that to the Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chairman, Representative Ramers, to be specific, are you speaking about the Uzinki Airport?
Yeah, probably.
Uzinki is on Kodiak Island, and it's actually in Senator Stevens.
No, that's not the one.
That's by Cold Bay or something.
One by Cold Bay.
There was another, our project was Akachak out on the Kuskokwim River, and there's certainly more than 20 people that live in that community, so I just want to make sure I have the right numbers and location.
I'm recollecting a newspaper story that I read about, an enormous appropriation for just a fractional community, not an unimportant community, but just a community of very few people as opposed to a center of 100,000 people who lack basic services. Well, I don't care what the rules are. Senators can do anything. I mean, I know that as a House rep. Man, we got very few powers compared to senators. They got magic powers.
Oh, my.
So I'm just wondering if our, Mr. Mayor, I'm not joking. So I'm just wondering what kind of authority our U.S. Senate delegation has to look at tinkering with funding mechanisms to try and get some money to fix this problem sooner rather than later, and then go back and finish that other airport over a period of time. Or do we have any ability to do that?
Through the chair, Representative Ramers, again, if it's, as Representative Johnson said, what I recall one of the most newsworthy or most publicized airports was Uzinki, where it was approximately $12 million for a community shy of about 100. That received national press after the issues in Alaska and what were deemed as airports to nowhere. Those funds were stimulus funds, American Recovery Act funds. That meant that those funds could only be spent on airports that were ready to go to bid. Shovel ready. So that meant we had the project designed and was ready to go. That project went out to bid, and that project is underway and will be completed this fall. That project will have consumed all of those funds available to them. What the Federal Aviation Administration does have available to them on a national basis is just a pot of discretionary funds. They give a set allocation to the state of Alaska based on our population, number of airports, a whole bunch of criteria that brings in a set amount of annual appropriations into the state. But in addition to that, they have a national pot called the discretionary pot that they, meaning the local FAA office division, can go back and compete on a national basis to fund needs such as safety-related needs, which is one of their highest priorities, and they compete on a national basis. They start looking for those projects and start gearing up for that now for the redistribution of discretionary funds towards the end of the fiscal year.
Well, Madam Chair, a follow-up. Madam Chair, in the interest of various regions of the state working together, I'd be very happy to sign a block letter supporting moving forward on any kind of discretionary funds available through the FAA, and my senator is on the line. I'll be happy to meet with him and talk about getting support from Interior delegation people, and would be happy to work on that on behalf of those of us that are friends that have an airport and no road to get to it.
Thank you very much. Any comments on the last comment?
Mr. Mayor?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate, again, the opportunity to come down here. We do have, as I said and as I stated before, there is some money in the kitty, in the bucket, to do the project, but not enough to get to where we need to get it done so that my public works director can get that thing in there and engineer it, but we can do it in rapid fire. I know there are things that had to be shovel-ready, and that was that came fast and down and quick last year, if I recall. You know, it's tough when you have a city bursting at the seams and you're trying to keep your costs down and you only have so many people you have working for you, especially when you're wrestling cost of living increases, union wages, and all the cornucopia of problems mayors have. But I think we're doing a pretty fair job in Wasilla. But with a little help and a little boost, we can probably get it where it needs to get and get ahead of this slide before we get buried in it. And I appreciate your help.
Make no mistake, we're all proud to call you mayor. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
All you do. So with that, I think Representative Johnson has another comment.
And actually, it's a question for the new deputy commissioner, if I could, Madam Chair. And it's one we talked about in the office, but I think it's important that we put it on the radar for everyone to be
could
aware.
Could we bring you up front and center again, please? Thank you.
Mark, the FAA reauthorization could have huge impact on tourism, hunting, fishing, the use of aviation in Alaska, particularly the 135 and 91, Part 91. I don't know how familiar you are with it, but it's where they now are accumulating hours as opposed to separating them on flying. Can you kind of walk us through the impacts of what this reauthorization would have for Alaska? And I know we're very short of time, and this could probably be a meeting on its own, but I do think it's important that people be aware that we are facing a major obstacle out of Washington when it comes to aviation in Alaska. Could you please kind of walk us through, as a committee, some of those perils and pitfalls?
Well, through the chair, Representative Johnson, I'm actually really not prepared at all to address this, but I would like the opportunity to do that because I agree with you. I think it's very important, and we are kind of, I know they are getting close to a version that's going to be agreed to by both houses of the of Congress.
Okay, a follow-up.
In that version, are the concerns that I've expressed still exist? Have they been able to be taken out by our congressional delegation, or are they still in the quote-unquote agreed-upon version? I know there's a firearms provision in there at one point, which would mean air taxis would have to go through the same kind of regulations as a commercial airline to take a gun hunting. So there's a lot of things in there that will have direct impact on the citizens of our state, and maybe that's something for a later date. But I did want to make sure it's on the radar, especially the members of the committee. It will be a huge issue.
And I would put on notice the committee members that this is just part one. We have the aviation overview, but we will have marine highways like we always do. So it's such a large department that we do want to be well informed. So we'll try to certainly section out our questions and get them to the appropriate people. And it's helpful sometimes if they even have these questions ahead of time before they come for their overview, allowing them to produce a PowerPoint that addresses a lot of the concerns. So you did a wonderful job. We thank you so much, and we welcome you. And we're available, too, so, let's keep the lines of communications open. And with that, I'm going to wrap up the meeting. Are there any final questions from any committee members? Seeing none, this is adjourned. Thank you.
All right, ready?